Please note, this episode contains descriptions of domestic violence, child abuse, discrimination against LGBTQ plus individuals, pedophilia, and rape. Listener discretion is advised. I am honored to introduce you to Jose Alfaro. We've been having our little chat beforehand, and it's just filled with love and affinity. And we've literally just met face to face for the first time after me admiring you and your courage and your transparency and candor with which you share this, you share your story. It cannot be that we're having a conversation about trafficking and not include the LGBTQ community. Thank you for being a voice for your community and our family, right?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It wouldn't be possible without platforms like yours to help spread this message. And, you know, it's quite common that we have a lot of people look the other way, which we'll touch base on based on my story, where people have ignored certain situations that are horrific because of sexuality or gender or the color of their skin. So thank you so much, Cheryl, for having me. I'm excited.
I'm excited too, Jose. So take us back to before it all began. Paint a picture of your life then, will you?
You know, so we were speaking earlier, and it's one thing to say before it all began, but I feel like my whole life has been a constant struggle. You know, you're born and then you wake up and you start to realize who you are, finding your identity, finding out who you are just as a person. And then you add gender, then you add sexuality, you add all of these different parts. And I think, and the reason why I'm bringing this up is because all of those different parts play an important role in sharing my story. Growing up down south in a very conservative town, it was really, really hard, one, to be Latino, two, to be effeminate and, you know, just feminine in general. A lot of people couldn't understand it or didn't like it. So I was constantly shamed for being feminine. Mind you, I grew up with three sisters. My mother's a daughter of 12 daughters, all women. So I grew up with a lot of women around me. I'm sure I picked up a lot of their mannerisms, the way they are. But at the same time, I felt comfortable and I felt stronger being more feminine. But because of that, I was constantly picked on. My father, was constantly telling me that I couldn't act a certain way. And if I acted a certain way, then I would be abused or in trouble. So I constantly had eyes in the back of my head, just making sure no one was behind me, watching me. And then I would hide and try to be myself behind closed doors, which was maybe playing with a Barbie doll or dancing and listening to a pop artists like Britney Spears or someone, and just dancing and living my life freely. And then you get into sexuality, because one, that was just figuring out who I was as a person. And then you add sexuality on top of it. And it was probably one of the scariest moments in my life. You know, after everything I've gone through, the scariest for me was trying to figure out who I was sexually and just my gender in general. I remember it was during this time where I had my parents telling me about religion, Christianity. We grew up Southern Baptist. You know, they wanted me to be a certain way and the way that God wanted me to be. And so when I started realizing that I was different and I had an interest in the same sex, I began to become fearful. I was afraid of the people around me knowing. I was afraid of God, what God was going to think of me. But I was also afraid of not being able to be man enough or good enough. And so for a long time, that was probably my biggest struggle. And to this day, I still have moments where I struggle, you know, should I wear this today? If I wear this, is it going to make me look too feminine? Is someone going to say something to me about, you know, how feminine I am, or because I might act a little gayer than the next person? So a lot of that still stays with me, even as an adult at 29 years old. But basically that is what started the whole, it's basically kind of what got me into a position to end up in a trafficking situation, for sure.
There's a question I had as you were speaking, and I wondered, when your father said you will get hurt or abused, did he mean by him, or was he looking out for you with somebody else?
It was by him. It was by him. My father was extremely abusive growing up, not so much towards us as kids, mostly my mother. We watched him abuse my mother physically, mentally, verbally. But as I started to get older, I think he started to realize that I was gay, and he had no control over that, and he did not like that at all. So the way he thought he could fix it was by abusing me. And so there were moments it got physical, there were moments that it got verbal. And so he put a lot of fear in me, thinking that no matter how I act, if it's going to be feminine, you know, I'm going to get in trouble, and there's going to be consequences for how I act. It's hard when you don't get to just move the way you move or talk the way that you talk. You've got to change it so that people like you or are comfortable with you or approve of you. So that has always been in the back of my head, for sure.
It's like it created the condition inside of which you needed anything else, something different. Okay, go on. Absolutely. Thank you, Jose.
Not necessarily coming to terms with my sexuality, my father basically went through my phone one day, realized that I was talking to another guy. And you can easily read text messages and understand that these text messages are probably not a friendship. It's probably more than that. And he realized that. And that day he called me into his room, argued with me, told me, tell me, is this who you are? Are you gay? And I said, I'm not. This isn't who I am. Mind you, I was not comfortable with who I was. And I begged God, God, please forgive me. If there's anything that I can do, if there's anything that you want from me, please let me know and guide me in the right direction. Guide me in the path and lead me the way that you want me to live my life. And I cried and I begged, but you know, it got to a point to where I was like, this is just who you are. You know, I was so terrified and so scared. And then it hit me. It's like, if God didn't want you to be this way, like, you know, things would change, things would be different, but there was no changing me. This was just how I was born. This is just how I was. And I could have fought and tried, but nothing was going to work. But that night he called me into his bedroom, confronted me. I said, yes, I'm going to change. And, I basically told him, no, I'm not gay. And he was like, okay, well then how are we going to fix you? You know? And then he ended up backhanding me. I blacked out. Police were called. And then the crazy thing to me is when the police came, they gave me one of two options. They said, one, either you can send your father to jail tonight, but he'll be back out tomorrow morning and he'll probably abuse you even worse. And they said, two, you could leave. And I'm like, I'm 15 years old, and the only option you're giving me basically is to leave my own home and to go somewhere where I'm going to feel even more uncomfortable about the whole situation. So I left, and I went with the guy that I was talking to that night. But then when I came back the next day, my father said, all right, we need to know how we're going to fix you, how we're going to change you. And I said, I had thought about it the entire night. I did not sleep. And I said, you need to move me somewhere new. Move me somewhere new. I can start all over. I'll become the man that you want me to be. And to be honest with you, I believed my own crap that was coming out of my mouth. And I believed, like, if he moves me, I'll be different. And he moved me to San Antonio, Texas, which was about 4 hours away from where I grew up. And I moved in with a cousin of mine. Mind you, my mother has the 12 sisters, so cousins are of all ages. This cousin was about the same age as my mother, so basically like my aunt. So I move in with her, and I start over in a brand new city. Well, a city in general. I'd never lived in a city, better yet, visited a city, because my town was so small. But I start going to this humongous high school. It was the first time I ever met anyone who was Asian. It was the first time I met any other form of Latino. All I knew was Mexican, white, and black. That's all I knew. And so moving to the school, I met a whole range of different types of people, gay, straight, lesbian, bisexual, black, white, Asian, you know, you name it. And it kind of opened my eyes into realizing that maybe this is okay. Maybe who I am is perfect and I should explore this a little more. And instead of doing what I said I was going to do, which was what I was set out to do, was to become more of a man, and I put that in quotations, I decided I was going to explore a little more and figure out who I truly was deep down inside. And with that happening, I ended up meeting a 36-year-old man. This 36-year-old was an ex-Marine. At the time, he was a teacher. He was teaching, I believe, like second or third graders. And we had a conversation, and he basically ended up telling me we should meet for coffee. Mind you, I had just turned 16 years old. And this coffee trip basically led to his bedroom. We never ended up grabbing coffee. We never did the things that he said we were going to do. He even said to me, there's no way that we're going to my apartment or into my bedroom because you're too young and this can't happen. But one thing led to another. And I think that deep down inside, he had already planned to take me home with him. And that day he ended up sexually abusing me. And kind of forced me into a sexual engagement with him. And then I left, and I'll never forget this feeling. I panicked. I'm like, what if I have an STD? I mean, we all know you don't show signs of an STD immediately, but the way that I was feeling and the way he was so aggressive with me, it made me think something was wrong. And so I contacted him and I told him I was thinking of going to the hospital, and he comforted me and told me everything was fine, that it was totally normal. And he basically made me feel like he was someone who cared about me. And we began continuing our conversations. We began meeting up once a week over the weekends. And then it was time for me to go back home to Navasota, Texas, where I grew up. After the semester was over. And that's when my father confronted me again and basically asked me again if I had changed. And I said, no, this is who I am. I cannot change.
Wow. Wow. You claimed it.
Absolutely. Amazing. I had to.
Yes.
I had to, but not only that, the 36-year-old that I was with basically kind of gave me some information about the LGBTQ community, but also meeting someone who was so masculine and older and more experienced, it made me feel more comfortable with who I was. As much of a negative influence he was on my life and the horrible things that he did to me, there are some positives that I took out of it. And one of them was figuring out who I was and feeling comfortable with myself. So I told my father, this is who I am and you just have to deal with it. And he said, either you're going to conversion therapy camp, you're going to these church camps over the summer, you're doing this, you're doing that. And he said, or you're getting out of my house. And I said, I'll leave. And in the back of my head, I was like, I'll just move in with a 36-year-old because it's that easy.
Right. You can't pray the gay away. Let me.
I prayed it away and it never went away. So. So I move in with a 36-year-old, find out over the summer that he was cheating on me with other underage boys. And I decided I was going to go back home. Mind you, during this time, he was sexually abusing me 4-5 times a day. And on top of that, cheating on me. So I assume he had a much larger problem, than just, I think he had an issue like a sex addiction, but also obviously a pedophile. So I left. Went back home with my parents and I was thinking, okay, some time has passed. They didn't think I was going to last on my own. But I kind of lasted on my own for a little bit. And I come back home and I'm thinking, they're going to accept me. They're not going to have a problem with it. Everything's going to be great. Sure enough, within a week of being back home, my father is like threatening to hurt me, chases me out of the house. And I end up going to a girlfriend's house and she's like, I think you can stay the night for the night. She's like, but I don't know about after tonight. And I understood because I have 3 sisters and I know how my father is and no father is going to feel comfortable with a teenage boy living in their home when their daughter's in the room next to theirs. So I told her, don't worry about it. I'll figure it out. I said, I figured it out from this point. I'll figure it out from here on. And I went online to a website called gay.com. It was just a gay chat site at the time. You could meet people or just chat with them. And this very, to me at the time, attractive, fit, good-looking guy in his mid to early 30s messages me and asks me how my day is going. And I told him exactly what was happening in my life. And he says to me, I feel horrible that you're going through this right now. I'm fortunate enough that I have a family that is accepting and has never did anything like that to me. He said, but I have friends who've been in similar situations. And the only thing that I feel I need to do is to help you. And he said, I really feel like there's something I can do for you. And he said, I have a 9-bedroom home in Austin, Texas. He's like, I'm visiting Houston at the moment for business. He was like, but in a few weeks, I'll be going back to Austin. And he says, I would love to help you out. He was like, if school is a priority, we could look into private school. You know, he's going on and on about these things that sound amazing. Wow. I'm like,
right.
I'm like, this is perfect. Like, this is all I could ever ask for. This is all I ever wanted was acceptance, love, support, so that I could be the best person that I thought I was meant to be and exactly how I was supposed to be. And so it took me a little bit. We talked for a while. And then he said, can I come and pick you up? And by then I'm like, I have no other options. Absolutely. Come and pick me up. I can't wait to see this 9-bedroom home, this mansion that you're talking about. So he picked me up, took me back to Houston. We stayed in Houston for about 3 weeks to a month. That time is kind of blurry just because the time span, it's always hard to go back and say, oh, this was 2 weeks, this was 3 weeks. But we stayed in Houston for quite a while. And after a week of being there, he said to me, look, eventually you're going to want your independence. Eventually you're going to want to live a life on your own. You're going to want to support yourself. And he's like, and I know the perfect way. And I said, absolutely. Let me know how I can get this done. Like, how can I do this? That's all I ever wanted, was to be independent and on my own and live a life as myself. And he says, I work as a massage therapist. And he was like, I think that you would be a great partner. He was like, I would love to teach you how to give a proper massage. And basically, we would be giving what he called forehand massages, meaning obviously there's four hands involved within the massage. And he said, it's really easy. He was like, I'll teach you as we go. He was like, but you have to know that because you're under the age of 18, and he was like, if anyone asks you, you have to promise to say that you are 18 years old and that you're training to become a registered massage therapist. And I said, sure, totally easy. I got this. And he was like, well, this is my website. He had a whole RMT page, basically listing his services, but also had a photo of him without a shirt on. And he says, we have to get some photos of you that are shirtless. He was like, I've found that I get a larger clientele. A lot more people want more services when they can see the person and notice that they have a great physique. And I said, okay, I'll do that. So I spent the day taking photos, and then it was time for the first massage. Yes. But this is basically, for me, this was a moment where my age played an important role. You know, this is how he easily kind of worked his way in and manipulated me into thinking that this is going to be the best choice. This is going to be great for you. You're going to live an awesome life. And as naive and young as I was, this sounds amazing, is basically what I said. Let's do it. And I go into the first massage, and I want to paint the picture of what it was like. It was a bedroom with a large bed and windows that he placed bed sheets over the windows to keep the light from coming in. He lit a few candles and had some kind of Asian music playing, to set the mood. And as I walked in, there's a bed right in front of a massage table, right in front of the door. And there was a middle-aged man, completely naked, laying on top of the table. And I'm not going to lie to you, at first I thought it was hilarious. And I thought it was hilarious because I thought it was a mistake. I thought the man was supposed to be under the sheets and he just didn't know that. And so I kind of thought it was funny. And then Jason walks behind me and closes the door. And when he closed the door and locks it, that is kind of when I was like, hold on, why do you have to lock the door? What's going to happen from here on? And then he begins to take his clothing off. And when he took his clothing off, I already knew. I already knew where this was going. I already knew what was about to happen. And I just remember feeling like, there's no other way. This is it. Like, you're stuck here. This is what you have to do. And I ran through all of my options. And every single option led me to the same spot, is you're stuck. You have to do it. Because if you say something, they're going to react somehow. And one, either Jason's going to send you back home. Two, Jason's going to hurt you. Three, maybe this client might think oh, like no one knows I'm doing this. What if this boy leaves and goes and tells everyone or goes and tells law enforcement and then I'm in trouble? So I was just like, you're better off just not saying anything and just doing what you have to do.
Right. None of those scenarios could have worked out in your favor.
Right.
People have no idea because the common question is, well, why didn't you leave? Why did you stay? Well, these reasons, you're in bona fide survival and looking at the options and none of them work except stay.
Right. Right. And on top of that, of course, thank you. Of course, but on top of that, it's like, where am I going to go? If I made the decision to leave, I'm now in Houston, Texas, a city that I know absolutely nothing about. I'm 16 years old. Where am I going to go? Who's going to believe me? Clearly, the police already gave me this feeling that they're not going to help me in any situation. You know, when my father abused me, they basically looked the other way and said, you should probably leave your home. Who's going to help me? And it was just like, okay, this is what you got to do. And then you start thinking, maybe this is okay. Maybe there's nothing wrong with this. And I had seen the movie Taken. I've seen what that's all about. And none of this seemed like the same thing in my head at the time. And I'm like, no one's drugged me. No one's tied me down. No one's taken me across seas. I'm just in this room. And technically, I guess I could just leave whenever I wanted. But at the same time, like I said, I had no other options. And so we went through with the massage, and it was during the massage, we're rubbing him, we're touching him. And then the guy just starts grabbing me, and he's touching me inappropriately, grabbing me in my genitals. And then I hear the most uncomfortable sound, and I knew exactly what it meant. He started making these mouth noises, almost like he wanted to orally have sex with me. And when he started making these noises, that's when Jason looked at me and he said, okay, you're good to go. And so I leave the room and I feel so filthy after the massage. I feel like I knew this was bad. I knew this was wrong, but I also felt like, okay, if that's all it was, I think I can do this. I think I'll be okay. And then as soon as I have enough money, as soon as I get my life together, I'll be independent and I won't have to do this anymore. I'll be good. And that wasn't it. You know, the massages began to progress. They got worse and worse as it continued, you know, and it got to the point to where leading up to the last and final massage, I was raped by one of the clients. And the way that this happened was Jason had already had this planned. And I guess the client messaged him and said, I want to massage the boy that's with you. And so I guess Jason told him it would be extra money, gave him a price. And I'll never forget that day, because that day I just felt like something's going on. Something is going to happen much different than the way things have been happening. And sure enough, I was right. As soon as that door closed, Jason looked at me and he said, all right, the client wants you to get on the table and he wants to massage you. And I said, I had a moment where I paused and I was thinking of saying no, like this isn't part of the plan. But again, I go back to those moments and thinking, well, if you say no, what's going to happen? So I get on the massage. He starts to massage me. And then I hear his pants unzip. And I just remember feeling like blackout. Like you go numb to the feeling. And he basically had sex with me unprotected. And it was so disgusting, so gross. And I remember just laying there on the massage table, and he walks around the massage table with his clothes still off and kisses me on my forehead. Kisses me on his forehead. Had a wedding ring on. Had to have had children my age, I assume. And I just remember thinking, this is not okay. This is not okay. I feel so gross. I feel filthy. I feel disgusting. I feel worthless. I feel this is nowhere in my dreams, in my plans for my future, did I ever see this being part of my life. And it was that moment that I decided I'm going to leave. And the only place that I knew to go was to go back with a 36-year-old. I didn't feel comfortable going back home. I had tried several times. They kept kicking me out, fighting with me. And then for me, it was just like, where else am I going to go? And I think one of the biggest questions that I get is, what about organizations? What about, did you know anything about, I knew nothing of that.
Who knows about that kind of thing?
Right.
Nobody knows about that kind of thing. I mean, it's you can find out about these things by researching about them, but people in need, it by and large, have no idea.
Right. Right. On that topic. So I leave, I end up getting the 36-year-old to come and pick me up. And I get out of the situation. Basically, I told Jason I was going for an early morning bike ride. In reality, I actually had already planned it. I sent a message to the 36-year-old, told him what was going on. Which is insane to me. He was extremely upset, saying, do you realize what he's been doing to you? Looking back, I'm like, did he realize what he had been doing to me? But I basically remembered that there was a huge wad of money in Jason's truck. And so I went through the garage and I opened the door to his truck and I looked for the money and I found the wad of money and I was like, I'm taking this with me. This belongs to me. And I remember jumping through the window because I knew if I opened the garage door, Jason was going to know that something was up and God knows what was going to happen from there. So I jumped through the window, I'm running towards the car and I'm like, my heart is racing, but at the same time, I have this feeling like I'm saved. You know, things are going to get better from here. Little did I know that when you experience trauma like that, there's a long road ahead of you. And shortly after, I began to see signs of PTSD, anxiety, depression. And
physically
also,
free doesn't mean mentally and emotionally free.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And I think that was also the case with Jason at the time was, you know, no, I wasn't tied down. No, I wasn't locked up somewhere. But mentally, I was. Mentally, he had me tied down and locked up. And so from there, I go back with the 36-year-old. And of course, he's still cheating on me. He's still doing the things that, you know, he wants to do. And I don't even realize how much trauma I had experienced in such a short time and what it was doing to me mentally. And yes, I had always suffered from anxiety my whole entire life, but I didn't know what that was and how it was triggered and how it was affecting me. All I knew was I feel uncomfortable. And I remember it turned into the second the 36-year-old would get up for work and leave, I would go and search through everything. I needed to find signs of who's he cheating on me with? Who's he sleeping with? What is he doing behind my back? And it was every single day. And it was to the point where I started to go crazy. Like I can literally tell you, I went mentally nuts. I put a knife in between the mattresses thinking one night, if I need to, or when the time comes, I'm going to kill him. I'm just going to do it. And that's how, and in my head, it felt normal at the time. It was like, this is what you got to do. This is what you're supposed to do. You know, and I look at some of the trafficking stories that have been a little more public and recent of trafficked victims killing their traffickers or the clients. I kind of understand it now. You know, when you're abused and you go through such trauma for so long, you kind of lose sense of reality. And you think that something, a response like killing someone is okay. Because it's, to you, it feels like it's the only way out of whatever situation that you're in. And
your
finally
have become so compromised that your sense of right and wrong is a fluid thing. It has to be in order to accept the wrongs that are occurring, that the there is such cognitive dissonance between what's happening and how wrong it is. And what you have to tell yourself, like you'd said, this isn't that bad. You have to do that in order to literally survive. Goodness. Okay.
That's exactly how it was. I remember there were nights where the 36-year-old would have sex with me so many times, and I was in so much pain. I mean, I would bleed. I'd have cuts. And I remember saying, like, no, I don't want to. I don't want to do this. And I had no choice. And he was like, you'll be okay. You'll get through it. And I remember thinking, exactly like you said, this isn't as bad as when I was basically being trafficked with Jason. And so I settled, you know, and I started to think, like, maybe this could work. Maybe I could have a relationship, a real relationship with the 36-year-old. Maybe he could love me one day. And maybe this will be what I've been searching for the entire time. Love, acceptance, support. And it was never any of those things. It was all about pleasing every man that came in contact with me. And that's mentally what I started to think is what I was supposed to do. And that affected my relationships even to today, thinking that sexually, I have to be this slave to every man that I meet from here on out. And that's not okay. That's not a way to think. That's dehumanizing and it's horrible. But during this time, there was several moments where law enforcement was involved, where counselors, therapists, guardians, and I'll tell you what I mean by guardians, people became aware of my situation, but not once flinched in thinking that what was happening to me was rape, being sexually abused, kidnapped in a sense, or trafficked. And there was one time a police officer showed up at the door when I was staying with a 36-year-old. There was a noise complaint because we were arguing and fighting because he was cheating on me and I confronted him. And if you know any teenager, you know that their reaction emotionally is always anger first. And that's how I reacted. And the police officer not once asked for an ID. Clearly, we look completely different. Didn't ask for an ID, didn't ask my name, didn't ask anything. And that was one moment where law enforcement easily could have stepped in and helped me. Another one, there was because the 36-year-old was a teacher, we were at Starbucks one day and one of his students' parents walks up to us and says, "Oh, hey, good to see you. Is this your son?" And I just remember a huge pause from the 36-year-old, and he just looks at her and he's just like, "No, it's just a friend of mine." And another moment where someone could have stepped in and said something or noticed something was wrong. Then for me to legally move in with Cody at that time, or the 36-year-old, his name is Cody. For me to legally move in with him, I needed to enroll into high school. And the only way that you can enroll into high school is if you have a parent guard or a guardian, legal guardian, to sign you into high school.
What?
So yes.
I'm your legal guardian?
No. Oh. That would be awkward. That would be awkward. No, so we contacted a lawyer, and the lawyer said, what you can do is you can go to a homeless shelter, and he's like, I can give you the number. Basically, claim yourself homeless, and they will provide you with a legal guardian. And so we go to this homeless shelter. I sign the form. They provide me with a legal guardian. Don't ask me questions about why I'm with this guy. What is it that I'm going through? How can we help you? It was basically like, okay, you're homeless. We can give you food stamps. We can give you these gift cards. We can supply you with school supplies, and we'll enroll you into school. End of story. No one came to the house. No one checked on how we were living. No one checked on anything. And again, another moment where someone easily could have stepped in and helped. And then I think the last moment was, because I was missing so much school, mind you, previous to being trafficked and in this situation, I was on the cross country team. I was on the track team, the swim team. I was in choir. I was in the band. I did it all. I did anything and everything because I knew that I wanted a future. I wanted to go to a university. I wanted to become someone very successful, and I wanted out of my current life. And I had already had a lot of my credits. I began getting college credits for some of the courses that I was taking. And so the school counselor noticed that I was missing a lot of school. And she told me, basically, we have another option for you if life is just too hard right now. And she said, the option is you can go to this separate school where you can just hurry up and get your credits so that you can start working. And again, didn't ask me, why am I struggling? Why am I not coming to school? What, red flags everywhere. and ends up basically putting me in this other school. I graduated early, and it just made it easier for more people to take advantage of me. From then on, I ended up going to jail right when I turned 18. The 36-year-old ended up calling the police on me because I pushed him, because again, I thought he was cheating on me. And when I pushed him, I thought, well, you're not going to call the police, because when the police come, I'm going to tell them what you've been doing to me since I was 15. But little did I know that's not how it works. And so the police come, they asked me if I pushed him, and I said, of course I pushed him. And they said, I'm sorry, but you have to put your hands behind your back. You're coming with us. And even in that moment, I'm thinking, they're going to help me. They're going to help me out of this situation. They're going to take me to my parents. They're going to save me. And I remember sitting in the back seat with my hands behind my back in handcuffs. And I said, when am I going to see my parents? And they said, sweetie, you're 18 years old. Like, you're an adult. You're going to jail tonight. And I just remember thinking, no one's ever going to help me. No one's ever going to help me out of this situation. It's too late now. Yeah. Now I'm an adult. There's nothing I can do.
How do I get my childhood back?
That is probably one of the biggest things that I struggle with today, is thinking, how will I ever be that version of Jose again? When will I ever be innocent, naive, and just have a time in life where you get to just figure out who you are and grow and being kicked out of my home, everything was hard and it was a struggle. And it was all survival. Everything was survival. After being in jail that night, I ended up getting a place on my own. It was basically I was living with two drug dealers that I did not know, that I met on Craigslist, that had a room available, very cheap. And I was like, this is great. Like, this is how I'm going to start a life on my own. I enrolled into college. I did not complete college. I probably completed two semesters, but life was just way too hard. And I began drinking a ton. I began partying nonstop. I began doing drugs, cocaine, ecstasy, Molly, and tons of alcohol. And I began to support myself. I did what I knew best, and that was now giving massages, giving nude thought massages on my own terms. I felt I have control over this. There's nothing wrong with this, and I did it. And so I would give sexual massages whenever I needed, and I began webcamming, which was a sexual webcam site where I would get naked basically for anyone who was willing to pay me. And little did I know that the more and more that I was doing that, the more it was just destroying who I was. And I ended up getting to a place to where I was just so depressed and my life was so dark. And all I had was this room in a crack den, and a mattress on the floor with two sheets and a CD player. And I remember looking back at that time and I was like, you're doing pretty well. Wow. Yeah. You know, that's what I thought was success. I did it. I made it. And from then on, I ended up getting into the sugar baby, sugar daddy type relationship. I began being flown all around the US. And then I ended up with a sugar daddy in Boston, Massachusetts, and which is where I'm at now. Not with a sugar daddy. but it ended up being a blessing in disguise. This guy that I ended up moving in with, by the way, I was 20 when I moved in with him. He said to me, which this never happens, and I do not recommend anyone getting into that type of relationship. It can be extremely dangerous and scary. You don't know who you're going to meet. But I met this guy, and I'm living with him, and we're both kind of realizing that this relationship isn't really working. And he offers me a place to stay, rent-free, food on the table, and he says, under one condition. And I'm just like, here we go. What is this man going to want from me?
Yeah.
You know, I thought this was going to be over, but he says, you need to go back to school. And I can't even tell you, you'd think that I would have a sigh of relief.
Right.
I literally was like, no, that's not what I want. I don't want this anymore. I don't want to go to school. I have no drive. I lost every part of me. Every single thing that I want it to be, that I want it to become, I lost it all. I lost all of it. I didn't know how to love myself anymore. I didn't want good things for myself anymore. I wanted people to just give it to me. Just give it to me. Tell me what it is that I have to do so that I can have what I want. And that's not how life works.
And yet, but you're telling the story, the logic is inescapable. The progression from the boy you were to the man you were becoming, it makes logical sense how you got there. Mm-hmm. So then what did you do? Because the irony is, as you're talking about lying there or being there in your room with the mattress lying on the floor and the two sheets and saying, wow, I've made it, because you really have made it now. And
oh, well, you mean today?
Today.
Yes.
Yes.
I thought you really meant with my mattress on the floor.
Say it again.
I thought you meant I made it when I had the mattress on the floor. Oh.
Well, in some regard you had, because you'd become self-sufficient, not in the way you wanted, but
right.
you had. It's incremental steps, right? But now today you have, and how did you traverse that massive canyon between being in this sugar daddy, sugar baby relationship with a guy who seemed like a solid mensch, right? He wanted you to go back to school in some
right.
regard, right? Maybe that's an exaggeration, but then how did you get there to where you are now?
So I did end up enrolling into school because he said I had to leave if I didn't follow his rules, which was just to go back to school. So I went back to school. I got a job. Crazy enough, I got a job at Massage Envy as a receptionist. Yes.
I can't. Oh my God. Okay. They're like, have you ever worked in a massage? Holy moly, you don't want to.
Yep. You know, and the answer to that question, anytime I was asked, I said, yeah, I know a lot about this.
Yes.
But I became a receptionist at Massage Envy for years. And then once I enrolled into beauty school, I got a job at my first salon and I became a receptionist at the salon while I was in school. And I hated it. I hated beauty school. I hated having a job. I hated working. But then I met David, who is my current boyfriend, and we've been together for 8 years, and I
Amazing.
Met him. It's just crazy to me, that I met someone so great and so successful, and the last thing he's looking for is sex with me. You know what I mean? Like, he's not just looking for sex. He's actually looking yeah. for love, something that I had been searching for my entire life. You know,
yeah.
And so I began working I get my license to begin working as a hairstylist. And I realize I have a talent. I then begin building myself up. It's all about starting from the bottom, right? And then working your way up. And I did that. I worked my ass off. I was at the salon every single day. Day and night, I was in beauty school. I did what I had to do. And then I had a friend come and visit me from Houston, Texas. And he was an older friend. And he says to me, I know what happened to you when you were a teenager. And I'm like, no, you don't. Like, what are you talking about? And he's like, I know about Jason.
Whoa.
And I said, yes. Suddenly my whole world just collapsed. Everything was flipped upside down. I'm now back into the same mindset that I was in at 16, at 17, at 18. And I'm like, I'm never going to move on from this. This is never going to be over. And he says, I know what happened. And he's like, Jason is in prison right now and he's like, he's awaiting trial. And he said, they're looking for more victims with more information. And he goes, and you need to call this hotline. So I contacted the human trafficking hotline, and I told them my story, what happened to me. And then they get me in contact with Homeland Security. Homeland Security tells me, meet us in our Boston office.
You had to get yourself all the way there from Boston.
No. So I actually met them. I met them. This is crazy. I went to the Homeland Security office in Boston. And then I met Sherry Zack. Sherry Zack is the U.S. attorney and the lawyer that basically helped us through the entire case and put the whole case together, found all the other victims that were of Jason. And from there, I had to retell my story in front of like five officers, including Sherry Zack and her her partners. And mind you, this is in 2014. He was arrested in 2012. And then we go to trial in 2018. So 6 years, we were waiting to go to trial. It's a very long process, very miserable process. There were many moments where I thought nothing was going to come of this and that I should just forget about it and I should move on. Thank God I didn't. And I ended up being contacted by Rio Grande Legal Aid. And I believe they're located in San Antonio, Texas, or Austin, Texas. Anyway, so they messaged me asking if I wanted to pursue a civil suit against Jason. And I'm like, I don't know what that is. And they're like, I was like, what is it going to cost me? And they're like, nothing. They're like, wow, we just want to help you.
Okay. I'll take it. Look, finally, people are helping you.
Right.
Law enforcement is listening, right?
Yes. They were listening and they were so kind. I consider everyone who worked on my case like family because, I mean, over a span of 6 years, all we did was talk and talk about my story and talk about my life and how am I doing now? And so they become your family. They become these people that you're contacting constantly and they're in contact with you. And it's just incredible to me how things suddenly started to bloom, you know. And I don't like to think of it this way, but sometimes I feel like maybe this was my purpose, maybe not to be trafficked, but maybe this was my purpose to help others in similar situations. Every gay boy that's out there whose family neglects them and kicks them out and says, figure it out, I want to be able to help those boys. I want to be able to help the kids that aren't even aware that what's happening to them is trafficking and how wrong it is. And if you end up in a situation like that, I hope they know what's to come after. And it's going to be really hard. I always say it was much harder after being trafficked than actually being trafficked. For me, it was, at least.
Because you're left with that hell between your ears.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, now you just gotta move on. You just gotta deal with it. And that's basically what I did. I just dealt with it. And I dealt with it in several different ways. The alcohol, the drugs, the partying. And to be quite honest with you, I think that I ended up where I am today because I partied so hard, I got in so much trouble. Well, I didn't get in a lot of trouble, but I got into a lot of fights. I was kicked out of like every club here in Boston. I was a mess. I was a terrible mess. And I even say to myself, rightfully so, you know, I didn't know what I was going through. I didn't know what was happening to my body, to my mind. And better yet, I lost my soul. I didn't have any respect for myself. I didn't care if men just wanted me for sex. I just didn't care anymore. And it wasn't until these other traumas started to happen to me, like a panic attack. I had my very first panic attack. I thought I was dying, but I came to realize that it was just stress. And then from there, I started to realize, okay, if this is stress, then how do I relieve my stress? How do I get rid of these feelings? Because I never want to have another panic attack in my life because it was that bad. I was bedridden for 2 weeks. I couldn't eat. I couldn't move. If I moved, I felt like I was going to pass out or vomit. My heart was racing constantly. And then I woke up with a mouthful of blood. I had chewed my tongue on both sides.
Oh my gosh.
From all of the anxiety. And then I started to realize what it was that I needed to do to change and to become healthy and normal or feel normal. And it took a lot of discipline. One, it was fitness. Fitness has changed my life in so many levels. Eating better, what I put into my body is what's going to come out, you know? You become your food, you really do.
Yes.
I began eating better. I began focusing on me. And I realized that I hadn't done that in a long time. How about we do what Jose wants to do today? How about if you want to go to the gym today, go to the gym today, but on your own terms, and it's because that's what you want to do. And I started realizing this. And then I realized, you know, when you go out for drinks, you don't have to have 10 drinks to have a good time. You could have one or two or three, but there's a limit, you know. And if you cut those drinks down, you might not wake up with that terrible headache the next day or that anxiety from the hangover. And I started to learn about myself a lot more on a level
that— You had to reparent yourself, it sounds, for the absentee parenting that you, from age 15 onward.
Absolutely. And, you know, on that note, you know, even going back home, I know everyone was just like, Jose's insane. Like, he's crazy. Like, the stuff that he does, he's not afraid. He's not scared, and he will do anything, and he's a party animal. And I think a lot of people look down on me because of that. And I will say, for a while, I was very ashamed of who I had become, but that shame was probably good shame for me because I needed to see who I was at that time, and it was not a good person. And because of that, I've been able to transform and discipline myself and become a way better version than what I was after what I had gone through. And no, I'll never be the young child Jose, but I get to be the adult Jose, and I get to be the best version of myself that I can be today. And I know that I've put in so much work for it, and I'm so proud of myself, and I'm so excited to see where life is going to take me, because it has been a journey, but an incredible journey. And every so often I just see improvement and improvement, and I learn how to take certain stresses off of myself and certain weights off of my shoulders. And I'm just like, holy crap, like, this is what it feels like to be free, to be who you want to be. And no one scares me. I'm not scared of anyone or anything. And I'm just ready to live life now, which is incredible and crazy at the same time.
It's just so glorious. It's remarkable that you were able to find this path for freedom when none existed. You didn't have the resources that somebody might have. You had to chisel this path out of stone and solid rock, but you did it. And I don't mean that as a judgment call, but it's very difficult as a survivor to forge your own path and to find a new normal. Because so often we're fighting to return to some land that doesn't exist anymore. Like, how can I reclaim my childhood? Well, it's gone. But you've created this beautiful new sense of normal that shines a light on the path for us all. And I just have to say, it's like, I imagine God is so proud of you. Back to where we started this conversation.
Yeah.
About thinking he was judging you and all that. You are an extraordinary human being.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I look back at certain moments in my life and I'm like, I should have been dead. I should have been in prison. I should have been, but there's someone, something watching over me and guiding me on the path that I need to be at. And oh my gosh. And there are several moments where I felt, I just want to talk about this one specific scenario because it is just crazy to me. One day I had chugged an entire beer. I was 18 years old at the time. And I found out that the 36-year-old was cheating on me. And I thought, I'm going to run down to his sister-in-law's house and I'm going to see him and I'm just going to go off on him. And I chugged this beer and I thought that was going to help me. But anyway, so I go for this run. I'm running out the door. I'm going to get him. I'm going to talk to him. And then I realize I don't even know where I'm at. I don't know how to get to her house. So then it's like 11 o'clock at night. I'm in the middle of nowhere. I don't know how to get back to the 36-year-old's home. And then this car pulls up and it's a red Nissan Altima. And the woman says, just take a step back for a second. She's like, I just want to make sure you're okay. And I said, I just started crying. And I said, I'm not okay. I was probably drunk off of the one beer. And she says, do you need help? And I said, I just need a ride back to the house. And she said, what's the address? And I told her the address. She goes, oh, that's not too far from here. She's like, get in. I'll take you home. And so she begins talking to me and she's like, something just does not feel right. And she's like, and I feel like there's something that I need to do. And I said, and I told her my story, I told her who I was living with and what had happened. She's like, I can't make you do anything. She goes, but I can tell you, you need to leave and you need to get out of this situation. And she gave me her number, wrote it down on a piece of paper. I left. That was that. About a month later, this is when I end up going to jail. And then I come back and I end up getting to a huge fight with a 36-year-old and his entire family. And they were ganging up on me and they were locking me in the house, telling me I couldn't leave. And I'm threatening I'm going to call the cops. So I call the cops. Sister-in-law ends up choking me. I'm running down the street, like crying, hysterical, thinking something horrible is going to happen to me. And then a car comes behind me and it's the 36-year-old and he's like, let's get back to the house. No one's going to hurt you. The police are there. Like, you just got to come back. And I'm like, okay. I wipe my tears. I walk back up to the house. And there's a red vehicle there. It's a red Nissan Altima.
Oh my God.
And she says, come over here. She was like, you're coming with me tonight. And I didn't argue. I didn't say no. I said, please and thank you for helping me. And she's like, come and stay with me. You can sleep on my sofa. She was like, we'll contact your parents and see when they can come and pick you up. And I mean, what in the world? Like, who, to this day, I don't even know who this woman is. I don't know where she is, but somehow she just popped up in my life and helped me. And, but there are several moments like that in my life where these people just kind of popped up and showed up and saved me from certain situations. And that for me makes me feel like, there's someone watching over me and there's a life that, and there's a path that I'm meant to go on. And when I prayed for God to help me and save me and guide me on that path, I think this is that path that he wanted me to take. And that's why I've survived all of this.
Yes. Jose, it's, you know, I want to end this conversation today on this note. The woman in the red Altima. We can each of us be that for the other people who are out there right now today, in the way that law enforcement originally weren't there for you. And those other people, the woman at the, when you guys were getting coffee, the parent, whomever that was, they dropped the ball, but none of us has to. We can, as the old saying goes, if you see something, say something. And it's incumbent upon us to do just that. Otherwise, these people continue to be locked in hell. And this will enable us to end human trafficking. No kidding. If we mobilize and each one of us says something, when there's something fishy going on, when we know better, when our gut tells us, no, something's wrong there. Absolutely. In the liner notes at the end of the of each episode, I include the phone number to text when there's when you need help or see something. But we must, each of us, do this. We can be truly angels on earth, just like she was for you.
Absolutely. Jose,
it is extraordinary to be with you today. Thank you for sharing your story and your heart.
I'm so happy that I was here today, and I'm so thankful that you had me on. And on that note, for me, like I always say, it's all about working on yourself as a person. Life is about learning and growing, and without growth, you're not doing what you're meant to do. And I think it's so important that outlets like yours, like your podcast, like our social media, allows us to help spread the education that we need to know, so that when we do see something, we know how to take care of it and how to take action. So like I said, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I'm excited to hear the final result.
Awesome. Well, it is my honor. Thank you. If you or someone you know has been taken for sex trafficking, or you suspect that's happening, call 888-373-7888 or text the word HELP to 233-733. With your help, we can stop human trafficking now. To keep up with all of our latest work, please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Trafficked Series. Please be sure to rate, review, share, and subscribe to our podcast. And listen to our next episode with survivor Holly Gibbs, who is a survivor of child sex trafficking, who went on to testify before Congress and consulted for numerous organizations, including the U.S. Office for Victims of Crime, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, the United States Department of Health and Human Services, and the Amber Alert Program. Be sure to catch this next episode with Holly. Until then, I am your host, Cheryl Hunter, and we are here to end human trafficking. So remember, if you see something, say something. This is a Conveyor Media production. Host and creator, Cheryl Hunter. Executive producers, Colin Whelan and Rebecca Sermons. Head producer, writer, editor, Celine Beth Calderon. And music by Mickey O'Brien.